Welcome. My name is Susan Daffron, and I'm the president of Logical Expressions, which is a book and software publishing company based in Idaho. I'm also the president of the Small Publishers, Artists, and Writers Network, otherwise known as SPAN. So thanks for listening. Today we're talking to Linda McDaniel and Virginia McCullough about how you can crank up your creativity. Both of these women have an amazing background in writing and creativity. And to give you a little idea of where they're coming from, Linda is actually the director of the Association for Creative Business Writing and is a writing and creativity coach for nonfiction writing. She's the author of 12 books, including her award-winning book called Words at Work. She's written extensively for a wide range of magazines and coached executives and staff for companies like Microsoft, T-Mobile, and Boeing, and a whole slew of other ones. And Virginia actually works behind the scenes as a ghostwriter and editor with individuals in, again, very diverse fields, ranging from prominent professional speakers to pioneering healthcare practitioners. She specializes in producing attention-grabbing nonfiction book proposals for clients who often go on to work with well-known literary agents and publishing houses. She's an award-winning writer, writing business coach, and consultant. So today they're going to share their tips and tools of the trade. So welcome both of you, and thank you so much for being here on the call.
Well, thank you. I always enjoy what I call sharing the fruits of my life and helping people with things I've learned along the way.
I could have gone on and on. You guys have the most amazing writing credits, both of you, and I'm really excited to hear what you have to say because you've worked with so many writers, and I know that there's a lot of issues that we writers all face. So
yeah.
So really, given that you do a lot of coaching, and as we all know, writers, sometimes we're our own worst enemies. I know I am. What techniques do you use when you're working with your clients and your the people that you're talking to about these issues? What techniques do you actually use to help us kind of outsmart those inner critic and inner saboteurs that keep us from writing? You know, the term that most of us tend to use is the more generic writer's block.
Well, that's a really excellent question. Linda and I have talked quite a bit about it, and when we met each other some years back, we both agreed that we found out through our conversations that we take a reader-centered approach to writing. And so one important way to fight back the saboteurs is to keep the focus on readers. And that means asking myself what my readers want and need from the particular manuscript that I happen to be working on. In some cases, that can mean actually picturing a reader, a typical reader for the particular book. And in other cases, it really is defining who the readers are, and there could be many levels of readers, the primary market and secondary market. But when you refocus your attention on readers, then you're letting these future readers keep you on track. So Linda and I both said we let readers keep us on track. And this often breaks a kind of energy slump that can sneak in when we approach work if the saboteurs are there and sort of operating. And I think it's always important to keep in mind when you think about readers is that writing, virtually all writing, is meant to have an effect on particular readers. For some readers, it might be as simple as telling them how to bake a pie. And then other readers, they want to know how to handle a particular medical condition. Other readers want to curl up on the couch and read a mystery. So all readers want something, and all of our writing is delivering something to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my take on that, too, is in my teaching, I learned this from editing my own work and realizing that in the first draft, I was not writing to my reader, I was writing at them. And that's fine in the first draft. Gosh, you've just got to get it down. But it's so important. I tell my clients, if they don't take anything else away, write to your readers. Now, let me give you tell you a little bit more about what I mean by that. It's like give them benefits and impact of something rather than just telling them the features of something. That just is going to hook them in like that. And answer what's in it for me and make it easy on their eyes. I mean, now, sometime if you're doing a book and you're not involved in the design, I realize you may not have that much say about that. But for those people who are writing articles to support their books or writing articles for clients and things, you know, use some white space and make it easy on the eye, because I just have this amazing... I would say in the 6 years I've been teaching, about 50% of my students confess that if they don't like the looks of something, they delete it or put it down. And that just shocked me. I had no idea that people had that little patience, you know, to make their way through something. So it's when I stop and think about that I'm doing something to help my reader or to make something enjoyable for my reader, that really helps me get over that writer's block. There's something about helping them and writing to them rather than at them.
So what's an example of writing at them?
Well, like when we just tell them, for example, like that, you know, my coaching practice includes, you know, 10 hours of this and 20 e-books that I will send you over the next year and that kind of thing. That would be just the features instead of saying, I'm going to show you how to bring out your creativity and turn that into creative prose and, you know, that kind of thing. And
yeah.
So it's like features rather than the benefit and impact on their lives. I have one example here from a business course I taught, and it was like, the union business assignments will be scheduled by the appropriate bus operators group to alert dispatch to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And of course people delete stuff like that instead of saying,
yeah, really?
You know, they could say, we're scheduling this meeting so you can understand what the union business administrators are offering you, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? It's like instead of just, oh, I think most people just want to get things like that off their to-do list. So they just throw down words and they don't think about their readers. And then, of course, taking it to a higher level, like I know your audience is, like they wouldn't write something like that. But even in articles, we can tell readers what we think they ought to know, but really it's what's going to engage them.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. And I think the more you can get into sort of, you know, the old cliche of walking a mile in someone else's shoes, the more you can get into the needs and wants of the reader, the more engaging it is. Because I've actually used the example that my books are always about, and this is an argument I always make to write about something that you're really interested in, because it's very easy to visualize the reader. It might be someone who's a lot like you. For example, when I wrote books about caring for adopted animals, it was really easy for me to visualize my reader because I own a dog and I know the dumb things that dogs do, and that, you know, so it's easy for me to understand the frustration of someone who's gotten a dog that's doing something they don't understand, because I've been there and done that. And I think the more you can empathize with a reader, that really comes across and does make it much easier to write.
Yeah.
Well,
it's like win-win, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You win because you actually know what to say, and the reader wins because they feel like you care. I think that's really important, too.
And you had a very clear picture of who your primary audience is, so that so that you that reader is never far from your mind. And a lot of books will have several levels of readers, primary readers, secondary audiences, and so forth. So I think that's what your example was, a really good one of how your readers will never be far from you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that in the experiences that I've had, a lot of times when people are really struggling with a book and can't figure, you know, it's just they can't get themselves to work on it, or they can't get themselves to write it, or they, a lot of times you hear people say, well, I just don't know what to say. I just, you know, I'm stuck. A lot of times it's they actually have not figured out who their reader is, and haven't gone through that mental pathway. And sometimes I've actually encouraged people to give your reader a name. It's like, particularly on a book where you're going to be talking about something for a long period of time. And actually, like, say, you know, my reader's name is Jane. She's 45 years old. She has 3-4 kids and is really stressed. And my book is about how she can run her household more efficiently. So, you know, Jane feels like her life is out of control and blah, blah, blah. And just going through this whole persona, and that tends to get writers outside of themselves so that they can move forward.
I agree. I think that's a very good idea. And I think that if a person feels blocked, they should, the first question should be about readers then, because I think you're absolutely right. Some people don't really know who their readers are.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of getting stuck, what are some other things, because, I mean, even beyond knowing your reader, there are other reasons we get stuck, too, and heaven knows I can get stuck. So what do you do if you're sitting there at, you know, the dreaded blank screen? What do you do?
Well, you know, my favorite technique to teach is what I call genius generator, because I truly believe that we all have not only ways to, like, get us unstuck, but we have ideas that we don't even know we have. It's been proven, I'd say in the past 5 years, neuroscience has made some amazing leaps. And they've proven that our brains are working on all kinds of levels. And we only mostly access the conscious level. And we through this genius generator, you're able to go deeper. And so if you're stuck, just stop. And here's the 5 steps. All you have to do, a lot of people may have even done this. It's kind of like speed writing. But I had an experience in a seminar I was teaching where I started to describe it, and this guy's face just lit up. And he later shared that when he was in high school, his science teacher made them start every single class with what I call genius generator. And he'd forgotten it. He wasn't using it. He was just all energized because he remembered how much creativity that brought out in everyone. So I'm going to share the 5 steps. And again, if you've done this before, I challenge you to do it more often, because we all, you know, say, oh, yeah, I remember that. Okay, here's the 5 steps. All you do is you set a timer. I like to ask people to do 5 minutes or 10 minutes. If you're getting really good at it, 15 is phenomenal, okay? So one, it doesn't take much time. 2, you write without stopping. So that timer is there so that your left brain can relax and say, oh, okay, the time's all taken care of. I don't have to worry about a thing. And you just type and type or write and write with a pen, and you don't stop, because that's where you go into different levels of your brain and up come these fabulous solutions and ideas. And then you go back and you circle the nuggets. So that's step 3, is circle the nuggets. Because sure, you wrote some, in order to not stop, you probably wrote even some scribbles or some stuff like, gee, I'm writing about my bio, I'm writing about my bio, or whatever you're trying to generate ideas about. And then 4 is to go back, because you've prioritized, so you've circled, I'm sorry, you haven't prioritized yet. You've circled the nuggets, but you haven't prioritized them, because what our 5th step is an organic outline. So once you've circled the nuggets, then you go back and say, in what order would my readers like to read these nuggets? So you give them a number, and then if you're so inclined, you could actually write out the organic outline that says, one, which may have been the fifth nugget down on the page, number one, number two, number three, and you put them in an organic outline. I find, too, that this, I don't know if they even teach those Roman numeral outlines anymore, but that was a major procrastinator for me because that didn't work for me. And I always tell my students, if that works for you, stick with it. But for those of us that that didn't work for, now you've got an organic outline that bubbled up from within, you know, it was within you and it came out. And it's so exciting. And all of this can be done in 10 to 15 minutes. And just like that student of mine whose face lit up when he remembered this, he told me later, all kinds of ideas were generated. So I hope people will use that to really jumpstart their writing.
Oh, what a great idea. That student, what an experience to have that student be so excited, too, Linda,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So one of the other... I think I missed a step. So wait,
okay.
It's one set a timer, two, write without stopping, three, circle the nuggets, four, put it in an outline?
Prioritize them.
Prioritize.
You know, just ponder, like... Oh, look at that nugget. I think I'd like to start with that one, even if it's way down on the page, you see. So you put a one by it. And then you look at all your nuggets that you've circled and prioritize them. And then if you're so inclined, you could write it out one, two, three, four, five, and have an actual organic outline.
So then number five is the outline if you choose to do it.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. That was what I didn't... I'm writing it down, so anyway.
Oh, good, yeah.
I wanted to make sure that I got all five steps. I'm like, wait, where's number five?
I wanted you to be sure to have them, so thanks for correcting me on that, because I think I didn't make that clear that five was the organic outline.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm actually, I've told this story before, you're going to laugh. I was an English major in college. I actually have been a writer for a really long time, but in high school, I actually almost flunked English because I couldn't, they had the, remember, and maybe you're old enough to remember this, I am, but it used to be that the way they taught how to do an outline was that you had to put things on index cards, and then you would do the whole Roman numeral outline thing like you're talking about. And for me, there was something about this that just, my brain locked up. I hated the index cards. I hated the whole outlining thing. It was really strange because now I can, like, I really sort of, like, automatically outline, but I just hated the system that my English teacher, the wonderful Mr. Lang, who I really didn't like, I just hated the whole, it seemed like a waste of paper to be, you could only put one idea on one index card, and I think that a lot of people got... in school, a lot of times, I think a lot of people, there were all these rigid rules like that, like you have to use one idea per index card, and you get all fixated on, did I only put one idea on there, or should I put on, you know, have I accidentally put in two ideas? So that, I mean, talk about something that stifles your creativity. So I think the idea of doing the organic outline is really great, because that is so much more freeing than, because a lot of times people hear the word outline and they sort of go, oh my God, an outline. That just reminds me of bad English class memories. I found a very similar solution, although I didn't really realize, I never have really done very well with free writing, but I discovered that, although I hate, to this day, I hate index cards. This is like some office supply phobia I have, I guess. But anyway, I love yellow legal pads. And when I was in college, I did that where I would actually write out a bunch of notes and I would circle them and prioritize them, just like you're talking about. And I think that somehow I think I needed more space than a than an index card. You know what I mean? That was just too restrictive for me. And I think that sometimes people don't realize that sometimes it's just the format that's really stifling your creativity and rules and all this stuff, that once you pull that away, you can actually get to the essence of what's trying to happen here, which is to let the words flow, but then also organize them. So that's really cool.
Yeah, it certainly is a different approach than the index cards of yesteryear.
It's funny how we all have these stories.
I know. I think we all have sort of nightmarish feelings about it. One of the other things that is good for various kinds of getting unstuck is to, as we say, get out of Dodge. And years ago, back in the 1980s, actually, I was having a problem with the last third of an article I was writing, and I struggled all morning trying to figure out what to do, just to get a couple of paragraphs, and then a transition, and then something else to finish it up. And I happened to live near Wrigley Field in Chicago, about a mile away, and I was a big Cubs fan. And I saw the clock getting more toward noon, and I finally gave it up and grabbed my jacket and walked over to Wrigley Field, where in those days you could walk up to the window and buy a ticket, and I felt a little guilty, but not guilty enough to not go, and I went up into the upper deck and I sat there and I watched the end of batting practice and the game started, and long about the fourth or fifth inning, the answer to the problem popped into my head, and I was able to I sat there and I thought about it, and I made sure it was really imprinted in my brain. And then actually, as I tell the story, this was April, and the wind switched around, and it got freezing cold in Wrigley Field. So I ended up going back home. I hadn't been smart enough to bring a hat and gloves, and then when I got home, I was able to go ahead and finish the piece, and it gave my brain that break it needed. It, mm-hmm. If I had sat there, I probably would have struggled all afternoon too. So that was a case where leaving the immediate situation helped. And I know Linda has more to say about this too, but getting unstuck can sometimes mean, if you can't leave your house, you can, if you're writing on the computer, switch to paper and pen. I use an Alpha Smart. I go off to a cafe or the library with my Alpha Smart, and I can't see what I'm writing. It's got such a small, like a 2-inch screen, so I can let loose and just write without the restrictions or the feelings when you're in your sort of official office, and so you really want to understand that the computer is not the only productivity tool you have. There are many, many things.
So what's an Alpha Smart?
Pardon me?
Am I just like not nerdy enough to know what an Alpha Smart is?
Oh, the Alpha Smart. Actually, it's a keyboard it's very small, although it's not as small as those little tiny computers. And it was used in schools a lot. I'm not sure it's used a lot now. It's basically a keyboard, runs on AA batteries, and it has a little screen. It even has a stick in it. I mean, it's got a lot of the features. I use it to just start something often, and like I said, when I need to get away. And they were using them in schools before they started putting computers in schools, but they still manufacture them, and they're an inexpensive, well, I call it an inexpensive productivity tool that weighs maybe a pound, maybe not even that, that can just be taken anywhere. And then when you get home, you just plug it into your computer, and it will transfer data into a file.
That's really cool. I've never heard of that. I'm going to go look that up.
The company is Neo, N-E-O.
N-E-O, okay, cool. Because it's like I can't, I know some people actually like type on their phones and Blackberries and stuff like that, and I just can't deal with that. But, you know, a lot of times you don't want to drag a laptop around, but that sounds like a kind of a nice compromise in a way. And I like single-purpose things. I tend to think that a phone should be a phone and a typing thing should be a typing thing. I mean, call me weird, but, you know.
Well, that is, then the Alpha Smart is probably right up your alley.
Yeah, I think
so. Because it only does what it does.
Yeah, cool. Okay. That's something I've never heard of. Awesome.
Well, I wanted to add, too, I have been, as you can tell, I've been reading some neuroscience stuff because there's some great books on the market that are written for lay people so that we can understand them and all. And there's one by Gregory Burns called Iconoclast. And, you know, he explains just like what Virginia has lived and I've lived too, where we got out and had a eureka moment. He explains that the brain gets lazy when it gets in a rut, whether that's doing the same thing, sitting at the desk all day or whatever. And now here's what he says about that. He says that we should take breaks and go somewhere new. And here's the quote, to jolt attentional systems awake. Doesn't that sound like a scientist then? And then he goes on to say the more radical change, the greater the livelihood of fresh insights. So Wrigley Field compared to a press release, or I'm sorry, an article, you know, that's just a radical change. And we, I think as writers, we don't give ourselves permission to have more fun. And some of the best writing I've done has been on ferries and commuter trains. There's something electric about the environment that, and now I understand from Gregory Burns why that happened. I also have a wonderful story. There's a world-renowned chef out here, Thomas Keller, who, the French Laundry, some folks may have heard of him, and he, I had the privilege of going to a book launch of his when I lived in Washington, D.C., and I got to meet him. And he told a story that I've never forgotten about when he was applying to be an executive chef early in his career, before he was so famous. He had to come up with an original recipe, and he couldn't do it. He froze. And this I really related to this because it's the same as of all of us writers wanting to write something fresh and exciting and creative, and we can freeze. So just luckily, a friend called him and said, oh, let's go out and get ice cream. So while they're at the ice cream shop and he's enjoying this ice cream cone, it comes to him, just like Virginia's solution came to her, and it was a salmon cornet appetizer, amuse-bouche kind of very small thing, but the salmon mousse is in a tiny little cone. And 3 decades later, that's still a signature piece at his world-renowned restaurant. And it's because he allowed himself to have fun and go with a friend and relax and have an ice cream cone. So I love that story. And
great story.
Yeah, so that's my 2 cents worth on having, when you're stuck, go out and have some fun.
Yeah, go watch a baseball game.
That's huge. Yeah, that's really huge. And actually, I think that it's another thing that really helps is, you know, just as a general way. I think, what did he say, that, you know, the farther away you get, the farther outside of your standard, you know, day-to-day life you can get, the more it helps. And I think that the sort of the corollary to that is that's why it's important to take vacations, because it's easy for people to get so wrapped up in their work that they never take vacations, and they never... And that actually, over time, ends up really harming their creativity. You don't have that chance for your brain to sort of recharge, I think.
Yeah.
You know, caveat, though, to this is that this kind of spontaneous creativity, or this kind of relaxed creativity, is really the reward for all for having already worked on a problem.
Yeah.
If I hadn't already been working on that article, the answer wouldn't have come to me while I was watching a baseball game. Action is rewarded in that sense. So that I just think sometimes people rely on inspiration and the idea of, oh, well, I'm going to write when I'm inspired. And really, you have to write into the inspiration sometimes too. And
yeah.
And I think really if anybody waited to write books until they felt inspired, there wouldn't be nearly as many books out in the world.
I know. People have often asked how I managed to write 12 books, and really it comes down to I wrote at times when I was not inspired. I didn't feel like writing. I didn't want to write, and you know, but I wrote it anyway, and I think that that's a really important point that people think they – I've often said that, you know, people always say they're going to go off into the cabin in the woods and write the great American novel, and then, you know, when's that going to happen? And and I actually, you know, arguably live in a cabin in the woods, and, you know, so, okay, I have a little more peace and quiet than other people, but, I mean, that isn't why I was able to write. It's still hard to write no matter where you are, whether you're sitting you know, in the middle of your office in Chicago or sitting in your cabin in the woods, it's you still have to put in that effort. I definitely agree with that.
Right. It's as if you have to write long enough to have the problem that then you can go away and get the solution to. You know,
yeah,
I
always call that that time getting away because I've read similar studies that says your brain is still working on things even though it doesn't seem like, you know, you've gone away and you're doing something else. But I call that percolation time, where, you know, just like coffee needs to kind of percolate, sometimes you have to go away and let your brain kind of be working on it. One thing I found that can be very helpful is to do something like I've refinished a lot of furniture. And sanding is actually very therapeutic because you end up, it's kind of, or gardening or something, where you're kind of doing something that's very physical. So you can't really be consciously thinking about whatever the problem is that you're, you know, the writing problem that you're working on. It's like, because you have to, if you're gardening, for example, you kind of have to focus on, you know, using the shovel and digging the hole so you don't drop the shovel on your head or something, you know, so, or sanding, you have to focus on the grain of the wood so that you don't, you know, make something horrible and hideous. Or I know a lot of people will switch to something like painting with, you know, as opposed to like using a computer, but painting with real paint and everything, so that you're doing something where it's much more physical, doing something with your hands that requires concentration. Some people, my sister actually, who's a creative writer, she often will go for drives because driving is another thing. If you're doing it right, you're actually paying attention to driving, and you're not really. You can still be thinking, but there are physical things that you're doing. You know, driving in traffic. If you have a standard transmission car, you're shifting gears. You're turning the steering wheel, so you can be thinking, but not the same way you have to think when you're sitting in front of your computer stuck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Walking's good. It's always good for that.
Yeah. Same idea. You're physically doing something else.
Mm-hmm. And you're observing things around you, but the ideas still pop in.
Yeah. In fact, sometimes my husband actually has introduced me to the joys of the whiteboard. He's a programmer, and when he was working at a big company, all the programmers, you know, how they love flowcharts and stuff. So they all had whiteboards. And so when he, you know, came back to working with me, he he saw a big white board at Staples. He's like, I want that. I'm like, okay, whatever. And so we have this huge whiteboard hanging in our hallway, and sometimes just the act of standing up and drawing, kind of like you were saying, if you're using a computer, switch to pencil. In this mm-hmm. case, it's like switching to standing up and using a whiteboard and being in a different room. It's like it's in our hallway. So sometimes that can be enough to just get you out of that locked up state that's so frustrating.
Absolutely.
So how else do you help writers just be more creative?
Well, one of the things I like to teach, and it's actually how I taught myself to write so many years ago, and that is something called deconstruction, or I call it imitate to innovate. And it's giving writers permission to, in quotes, copy writers they love. And what I mean by that is that you find someone like where you just totally resonate with their writing, and if you stop to analyze it, you would think to yourself, I'd really like to be able to write that well. Well, I like to invite people to give themselves permission to totally deconstruct what it is they love about that writing, and then try to do it that way. And when I first heard of this technique, I thought it was like copying or dangerously close to plagiarism. But, you know, when I went to a museum about the same time, and the text panel explained that Degas and Cassatt the two artists that they were focusing on in this exhibit, applied for permits to the Louvre to copy the old masters. And I was stunned. I mean, it had never occurred to me that artists I love had actually copied, in quotes, somebody else. Because the reason it's copied in quotes is they went on to have their own style, but it's sort of like muscle memory in a sport. You practice and you do those things, and then you're off and rolling on your own. And so I just strongly encourage people to tear something apart. Like what taught me, I learned by tearing articles in the New Yorker apart, because it still is to me the best articles out there. And it just taught me so much. So, and that's, you know, this is also a great unstuck technique. You're stuck, go find something you love, deconstruct it, or just use it to teach yourself and take your writing to the next level. So, and you know, people ask me, well, what do you do when you deconstruct? Well, how did it begin? What kind of an exciting lead? What kind of exciting ending? How did they keep the middle from dragging? So many books and articles just sag in the middle. And what kind, did they use similes? Did they use dialogue in a nonfiction, which you don't often see a lot of dialogue, that kind of thing. So just look for what you love about it and let yourself just wrap your arms around it and just take it all in. And I think Virginia has some other great techniques that help people really, you know, get going.
Actually, I also taught myself to write with deconstruction. And Linda just makes it sound more exciting than I ever thought of it. But I thought, well, that's true. Just breaking down other types of writing. But I think it's equally important to read a lot, and you can prime the creativity pump by reading your favorite kind of writing, either before when you're maybe trying to get ready to start a project, or you're feeling stuck about how to start a project. Going to a favorite author will often really break that. You start to get inspired. And I also believe in reading a variety of styles and different content. If you read the same kinds of things again and again, you don't get the kind of unconscious isn't working with you to get new ideas. But on a day-to-day kind of practical basis, one of the best tips that I ever heard about getting started and getting into the flow of your work, it goes back to Ernest Hemingway. And he always stopped his day's work at a place in the manuscript where he knew for sure what came next, even if it was stopping mid-sentence. And I've done that. I've done that a lot in my writing life. And the next time you sit down, if you've stopped where you know you're going to go, you can pick the work up immediately. There isn't it kind of bypasses a whole warm-up period even. And it's I found it very exciting, and I think it's one of those few things of that kind of tidbit that some of the master writers left behind. It's just certain kinds of ways to get into the work every day.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to not sort of write along and then get to somewhere you're stuck and then give up, because it's not, it's good to be able to just start with something that you know you're going to be able to jump right back into the next day, so that you don't sort of stall out before you've even started on, and as you go back to it.
I find that your energy is up when you know that you're going to finish a sentence,
and you can remember
what that sentence is. Your energy is pretty strong then when you sit down, and I think that it helps avoid the approach avoidance syndrome where you really want to do something, and you get there, and all of a sudden your mind is just for some reason telling you that you really don't want to do it now. And writing can have that. That's a problem within writing. But if you know you're going to finish a line of dialogue, or you know you're going to finish a sentence in the last sentence of a paragraph, somehow you can trick your saboteurs and just get started.
So we kind of talked about a reader-centered approach to writing. What about promotions?
One of the things that I've learned in this very long nonfiction career is that virtually all books have a primary and secondary market. So the promotional material or the approach you would take can be targeted to those markets. And I often use medical examples because I've done so much healthcare writing. But a book about certain kinds of serious conditions are often not targeted to the patient, but targeted to the family. Let's take a book about cancer or Alzheimer's. You have your primary audience for a book about cancer can be the patient, but it's usually also loved ones and family. A book about Alzheimer's, however, would probably have the primary caregiver as the primary market. But secondary markets for either of these, this type of book, could be nurses, nursing assistants, caregivers, medical social workers, all counselors, all the people who would be involved and are involved in the treatment of these particular patients. And you may not be able to reach the individual nursing assistant or the individual nurse, but you can reach nursing libraries, you can reach nursing newsletters. You can use this reader-centered approach to think pretty creatively about how to reach all of the markets. And I find that people get over reliant on the idea that they're going to be a guest on a big TV show or something. That's really more rare. And actually, I know a public relations professional that said sometimes the worst thing that can happen to an author is to go on the Today Show for the 2.5-minute interview, and they think that that's going to carry them over, and they don't do the other work that's a little bit more of a slog to find out who these secondary markets, what the secondary markets are, and then find creative ways to reach them.
So you sort of alluded to some of these other promotions. What are some of these more kind of bread and butter promotions? I mean, what kind of promotions have actually worked for you?
My clients, these are generally my clients or my co-authors who are the doctors.
Yeah.
And they tend to think about the big audience. Whereas I try to encourage and write press releases and do outreach to small regional magazines. If a particular healthcare issue affects mostly children, then you go to the parenting magazines, the parenting newspapers within communities. And now that with websites, then you would do a search for any number of that blogs and websites where you can alert the editors and the blogger about your particular book and why their readers would be interested in that. But I think the major point is that a one size fits all press release or direct mail piece or even a web posting is probably not as effective as targeted marketing to reader groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and something that I enjoyed when my Words at Work book came out was I did a virtual book tour. A virtual book tour where I let somebody organize it for me, but it's really, it would be just with a little bit of patience, something that anybody could do herself, and that would be, I think there were like 16 bloggers that sent me questions that I wrote out answers to, and then they posted them on their blogs. I was like a guest blogger, so to speak, for the day, and that was a lot of fun, and it was had impact because they happened all pretty much within a similar time frame. And then I have used, the new media with the Twitter and LinkedIn and lots of articles, whether that was in a article directory or for magazines. So those have all worked for me. So, gosh, today there's just so many avenues. It's almost mind-boggling. You know, you feel like you ought to be doing all of them, and time permitting, you can. Otherwise, I recommend people pick something that, you know, some that they're comfortable with, maybe a few that make them stretch a little bit, and don't try to be everything, to do everything.
Yeah,
there was one particular friend of mine that had, I thought, a pretty creative approach. Her book was published by a publishing house that marketed only to libraries. Their books were essentially written and produced for libraries. And what she did was make a postcard of the cover, and then she sent that postcard to all of the large circulation library systems in the country, and her first printing sold out almost immediately, and the librarians either ordered it right away or they saw it again the second time in the publisher's catalog, and so they had a second look. And it was a very, very successful marketing program and kind of old-fashioned, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I guess it really, for many books, would be a combination of the old and the new.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think a lot of people focus so much on the old that, or on the new, rather. It's like, you know, you have to set up a Twitter account, you have to be on Facebook, you have to do all this. But, I mean, really, where do people get books? Libraries. So, I mean, that's – and how do librarians find out about these things? Well, the publisher's catalog and postcards. And, I mean, it's a – you know, if your book is suitable to be in libraries, and many are, obviously, then there's certainly that's a really smart approach.
And it all comes back to knowing readers and having that hook that will hook particular readers in. And your hook is based on the group of readers you're trying to attract at that time. And, you know, readers sometimes have a feeling when they hear about a book or they see an advertisement for a book that somehow that book was written just for them. And
mm-hmm.
that's really what you're looking for, to in this kind of impersonal age in some ways have that almost personal connection with the reader.
So you're saying that's the hook is creating some sort of personal connection in your promotion using a hook.
I think that's the goal. It's like Linda was saying about features versus benefits. You can talk about a book lists the perfect diet for diabetes, but if it doesn't say something about how readers with the problem will benefit from it, if it's not personal, it might go right past them. If it says we have a better way of treating your health condition, that's a lot better than saying this is a pretty good diet for this. You know, it's bringing readers back in, and I think Linda, when she was talking about the benefits, what the benefits are, that will often make a reader feel like, oh, this person's talking to me. Yeah.
Well, for example, I know that sometimes writers can feel a little bit too close to their work to come up with a hook. So for Linda, when you were talking about you were promoting Words at Work, what was the hook that you used when you were, you know, say, setting up the virtual book tour? Because that's another place where you kind of need to attract someone's attention and say, hey, I'd like to be a guest on your blog. What kind of hook did you use for that?
Well, you know, I had somebody set this up for me, so I didn't have to convince the bloggers. But what I did need to do was give the readers something that was the hook. And
yeah.
for me, that is, I want people to stand out. I want their, you know, in this day and age of, oh, what difference does it make? It's all slapdash writing. It's all e-writing. And, no, half the people delete it. I mean, you've heard that over and over in the past, say, 5 or 6 years. And we've seen writing nosedive. But what I love to say to people is that if writing is nosediving and you do a good or even better than that job, you're going to stand out. Your book is going to stand out. Your article is going to stand out. Your blog is going to stand out, and you will stand out. And this is so exciting to me. It's like it's a no-brainer. If everybody is writing such sort of claptrap and you stand out with creative techniques, you're using similes, you're using dialogue and nonfiction, you're foreshadowing. Oh, it's my favorite technique. You know, just something as simple as, I'll get to that in a minute. I mean, just foreshadowing techniques. All of those things are going to make people stand out. So I want all of my clients, all my students, everybody I talk to, I want to give them a leg up. I want them to stand out. And good writing and taking your writing up a notch is exactly how to do it. So that's what my book was about. My book was about overcoming fear of writing and then going on to write so that you stand out and that you enjoy it in the process. And so, you know, I think my readers have responded to that.
Yeah, so the real benefit was, you know, as opposed to saying the features, the benefit was basically that if you take the, you know, make the effort to improve your writing so that it's beyond the norm, then you will have essentially greater success and greater rewards, and you know it will essentially make your career or your life better. So there's some real benefits for the reader who may have felt insecure in the past.
Yeah, so I wanted to address that insecurity because, boy, like you said earlier, we've all got it at different times for different reasons, and then help them move beyond that into outstanding writing.
Yeah.
And
I always thought it was Linda's book was so exciting because it was reaching people who don't think they're writers. They don't want to be writers necessarily. They're people that are out in the world. They're working in corporations. They're school teachers or they're administrators or all sorts of different people, and for them to get over that fear. I mean, it's miraculous, really. And then a lot of people can end up moving ahead. They can get the promotion because their writing skills are better. That's what I thought was so valuable about Linda's approach.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
So we're almost out of time here. Any final thoughts on powering up your promotions and your creativity and kind of bringing it all together here?
Well, I kind of covered it when I just said, but. I do teach a lot of business writing, and I'll have people come up to me afterwards and say, oh, well, you know, creative's great, but I really need to stay professional. And, oh, that just throws me for a loop, as if creative and professional are separate. And so I just urge people, like if anyone is thinking of writing articles or they any of your listeners are involved with writing at work and all, I say let it rip. I mean, I would love to hear the day when somebody is too creative at work, you know. And
yeah, really.
I just let it rip. Have fun. Let your readers enjoy reading something instead of that awful thing I started to read you earlier, you know.
Yeah, really.
And, Let that creativity rip and you know, I would if you'll indulge me for just a second, if any of your listeners are in Northern California, Virginia and I normally live 2,000 miles apart, but on October 28th we're giving a writing retreat in Walnut Creek, California, and it's a day long retreat and it's going to be a blast. So I did want to get that little $0.02 worth in there.
Well, actually, along those lines, make sure give me your website so that people can where they can find out more about the retreat, but also about some of the other stuff that you're doing.
Okay, well, for the retreat, and then it's on my website.
Okay.
Virginia has a great website, too. But just for the retreat, if they would just go to www.afcbw.com, that's the acronym for the Association for Creative Business Writing. So it's www.afcbw.com/writingretreats.html, and it's got all the info on that. And then Virginia's is pretty simple address, isn't it?
Yes, it's just www.virginiamccullough.com.
Okay, and well, that's good if you can spell McCullough. So it's
M C C U L L O U G H.
Okay, cool. I wanted to make sure we got that out there, particularly because of the retreat. And that really does sound like a lot of fun. And I'm sure, I guess you're going to be talking about a lot of these issues at the retreat, right?
Yeah, and then also giving people a chance to write. We designed it for people who are so busy with their everyday work that the things they want to write, whether it's a grant or a new web copy or whatever it is,
a book proposal, even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it always seems to get to put on the, it keeps getting down on the to-do list, down further and further on the to-do list. And so we designed this day for people to say, come on, get some writing done. You'll get some personal coaching. We'll have a roundtable discussion over a box lunch, and we're just going to just help you all just get energized again about writing.
Awesome. Well, that sounds like such fun. But at this point, we are out of time. I'd like to thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. And again, for those of you who want to read more about the retreat, you can visit the website at www.afcbw.com. And of course, you can also find out more about Spawn at www.spawn.org. So thanks, everyone, for listening and being here.
Well, thank you, and best wishes to everybody. Just